This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Journalist George Weller, a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the Chicago Daily News, was the first Allied journalist to reach Nagasaki after the atomic bomb struck the city on August 9, 1945. He entered Nagasaki not long after having been aboard the U.S. battleship Missouri to cover the September 2nd signing of the treaty marking the surrender of Japan. Weller was also the first reporter to enter nearby Allied POW camps. But his dispatches on Nagasaki and the camps didn't make it into the paper. They were stopped by U.S. censors. The paper never received anything from Weller. Weller thought his dispatches were lost forever. But a few months after George Weller's death in 2002, at the age of 95, his son Anthony Weller discovered carbon copies of the reports. They have now been published as First Into Nagasaki, the Censored Eyewitness Dispatches on Post-Atomic Japan and Its Prisoners of War. Anthony Weller edited the book. He also wrote introductory comments and a closing essay for the book. Anthony Weller, a journalist, novelist, poet, and musician, is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Anthony Weller. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. First Into Nagasaki is published by Crown. It will soon be available in paperback. 333-9455. 800-222-9455. Anthony Weller, good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks so much for having me on again.
My pleasure. Well, let's talk about Nagasaki. The war was over, but MacArthur had placed all of southern Japan off limits to the press. Why did your father decide he would defy the general's orders?
Well, my father felt that, first, we were now at peace and Japan was no longer the enemy. They had surrendered. So he felt that he had a right as a foreign correspondent to go wherever he wanted to. And he also felt, from a news point of view, that it was absolutely absurd that the journalists were being steered away from southern Japan, specifically the two nuclear sites where the war had been concluded. And this was the story that the world was waiting to hear, and yet nobody was being permitted to get it, and he was determined to get it.
Why had MacArthur put southern Japan off limits?
Well, he had a number of reasons. One was a kind of general vindictiveness about the press. My father, like the other reporters under his aegis, had been suffering the very tight strictures of MacArthur censorship for years now in the Pacific. At the same time, MacArthur was personally jealous of the fact that the war had been concluded by these two bombs that had been prepared without his knowledge and dropped without his command. His notion was a very slow, pawn takes pawn, 3-month opening of Japan like a cookie box with nothing to disturb it, and some say nothing to disturb his presidential ambitions. Instead, suddenly, he blinked. The war was over, MacArthur had not been consulted, and the last thing he was going to do was let a bunch of reporters go crawling around these nuclear sites and glorifying a bunch of New Mexico scientists at his own expense.
Yeah, the way your father put it was to keep the victory of two nuclear weapons from eclipsing a general.
Yeah.
Yeah. To what extent was this also about keeping the nature of atomic weapons from the American public?
Well, I think that ran profoundly through many of the decisions. I mean, another way to think about it is that it was really in nobody's interest for the true nature of the nuclear weapons to be exposed to the press. MacArthur had his own reasons, and of course, I think my father felt that centrally the fact that MacArthur, even 6 weeks after the bombs, had not offered any medical assistance was the crowning fact in MacArthur's decisions. At the same time, back in Washington and in the scientists in Tokyo now, there were many reasons not to expose the nature of the bomb. One was, as I'm sure you know, some cows wandering across a field had died right after the July tests in New Mexico. So there was the possibility that radiation would be seen as a dangerous force, which might threaten the GIs who were coming to take control of Japan. It might threaten all the U.S. POWs. It might also raise the specter of a poison gas. Remember, we had signed the 1929 Geneva Conventions of War, which forbade the use of poison gas. So any close look at that was potentially harmful. At the same time, as my father found, a number of American POWs and Japanese escaped the bomb even while being a couple hundred meters away from it, simply by ducking into trenches. So there was also the notion that, in fact, it really wasn't quite the super bomb that it was being made out to be. And I guess, lastly, there was a concerted PR effort on the part of the U.S. government to really spin the atom bomb story the way they wanted to. And a rogue reporter sneaking in and sending out dispatch after dispatch for weeks on end was going to upset that pretty rapidly.
Hmm. Now, the two bombs, Hiroshima bombed on August 6th, Nagasaki on August 9th, the two
right.
bombs were armed with different warheads.
Right.
How did that affect what happened in the two cities?
Well, I think what happened in the two cities was far more affected by topography. The Hiroshima bomb was uranium-235. Nagasaki was plutonium-239, developed at an extra cost of about $400 million or something. But what made Hiroshima's bomb so much more powerful was the fact that Hiroshima was a city built on a flat plain. And as a result, let's say approximately 100,000, possibly 120,000 people died in the first day and the first few weeks. In Nagasaki, those numbers were significantly lower, perhaps 40,000 to 70,000, depending on how you count. And that was a result of Nagasaki being a very, very hilly port city where the blast was sort of bounced like a basketball from hill to hill. And indeed, most of the deaths in Nagasaki came about as a result of the fires that broke out from the bomb exploding at lunchtime when many people were cooking meals in their wooden houses. So fires broke out and the city became a kind of Dresden. Mm-hmm. So I think topography has a lot more to do with it than science.
Mm-hmm. Your father arrived in Nagasaki 4 weeks to the day of the bomb.
Right.
What were his first impressions of what had happened?
Well, he described it as a city scorched but far from subdued. That in the harbor there were still a few wrecks smoldering, but that people were anxiously going around on foot trying to get things underway. They were burning the last bodies on improvised pyres. Parts of the city were intact. A good deal of damage had been done to the sort of military-industrial complex, which was the heart of the city. It was one of Japan's most important military plants, producing submarines and torpedoes and all kinds of weaponry. At the same time, of course, as his photographs attest, it was a city that had been devastated in a particularly dramatic way. However, remember, my father had just come back from seeing Tokyo, where on one night a firebombing back in March with ordinary incendiary bombs, 16 square miles of the city had been obliterated and over 100,000 people had died. So compared to that, this was much more focused.
How did his sense of the bombing and its aftermath evolve, however, when once he realized there was no aid coming in to help those who were wounded?
You put your finger on what I think is one of the most fascinating aspects of the dispatches, which is that he first arrives and he sees all these military factories that have been surgically taken out, as it were, by the bomb. And he, of course, he's seen a great deal of destruction in the course of the war by then. And in his first dispatches, he, I wouldn't say he praises the bomb, but he describes it as a strong but not excessive or unbelievable force, which is certainly different than the first visitors to Hiroshima saw that destruction. But then he starts to go into the hospitals, and he sees people dying in ways that he's never seen before in 4 years of war, and he realizes that something is going on here that's really quite new. He calls it Disease X. It's what we refer to now as radiation sickness. And he sees people who are absolutely dying before his eyes, before the eyes of the very astute Japanese doctors, with not a splotch on them, or people who have survived for 4 weeks feeling perfectly fit after the bomb, and then peeling a lemon, they cut themselves and they just kept bleeding, or their hair started to fall out a week later and splotches appeared on their body and they died. So as soon as he sees that, he's aware he's seeing something very different and horrifying, and the tone of his dispatches, while measured, definitely changes.
Hmm. The Treaty of Surrender was signed on September 2nd, as we've mentioned.
Right.
And not long after that then, or I'm not quite sure when it was, he decided he's going into Japan. How did he decide on Nagasaki?
Well, he decides he's going into, he's in Japan, he's in Tokyo, and he decides that he's going to make his way down, because what happens is right after the treaty is signed, there's several hundred journalists who are all expecting to be allowed to head down and see Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Instead, they're told by MacArthur, who's now the supreme commander, that southern Japan is off limits and they can only head north. And beyond that, there's no way to get south and the bridges are out and it's unsafe, et cetera, et cetera. And my father was really enraged by this and didn't believe it. And the only press junket that was being offered to reporters to take them south was a visit to an abandoned kamikaze field on a little island way off the, not far off the coast of Kyushu, the southernmost island. And my father was the only reporter who volunteered to go down there. And it was the airfield that was being used to land MacArthur's men at the southernmost tip of Kyushu to slowly work their way up and take southern Japan. And so my father gets flown down there a couple days after the treaty, and he spends a day dutifully writing rather dull stories about this landing. And then he apparently goes to bed for the night, but in fact what he'd done is arrange for a boatman to take him over to the mainland. And he gets up in the middle of the night, gets rowed over to the mainland, gets to the local train station, and spends about a day on a dozen or so trains crawling along 120 miles or so. And at some point, he had to choose whether to go to Nagasaki or Hiroshima. And he decided on Nagasaki because it was further away from Tokyo, and he figured there was less chance of there being U.S. soldiers arriving anytime soon. Remember, no U.S. troops had arrived at either site at this point. So that's why he ended up going to Nagasaki.
How long was he able to stay in that part of Japan before he had to leave?
Well, he was there a total of 3 weeks. He was in Nagasaki 5 days, then he goes up and spends 10 days among the POWs, and then another 5 days back in Nagasaki, and then he figures he's done everything he can, and he's gotten the message that his stories aren't getting through, and he heads off. Of course, the most dramatic part of it is when he arrives in Nagasaki, he realized that if he just presented himself as a journalist, he would get nowhere. So, like all reporters, he was wearing military khakis, and he arrived in Nagasaki and presented himself as Colonel Weller and demanded to be taken to the Japanese general in charge and told him that he was there under orders of MacArthur and he wanted every piece of cooperation possible, and he sort of brazened it out.
That was pretty risky behavior on your father's part, was it not?
Well, I think at that point he was, I think he felt as soon as the train chuffed into Nagasaki Station that he'd already won a victory just by getting there. He later described it as like that moment when a poem unties your mind. And somewhere in the train he'd realized that being a journalist was not going to get him a damn thing. So when the Japanese general said to him, and of course he looked pretty rumpled at that point, "How do I know you're here under MacArthur's orders?" My father said, "Well, if you don't believe me, just call him. But before you call him, you better consider the seriousness of your position." And the general just bowed to him and said, "What can I do to help?" And my father said, "I'm going to need both your cars, and I'm going to need military police to run my dispatches up to Tokyo every night, and we'll go from there."
When and how did he realize that his dispatches were not going to get out of Tokyo?
Well, he realized in a particularly depressing way, which was that the U.S. government, unbeknownst to MacArthur, had arranged a press junket of their own with a bunch of handpicked correspondents from the various radio networks and the New York Times and the AP and stuff like that, and they were being flown all over Asia. In fact, they were flown into Hiroshima about the 2 days after the treaty signing. And the purpose of this press junket was to get stories out disproving any claims of radiation poisoning. And most of these journalists were all old cronies of my dad from various campaigns, went along with this and sort of towed the party line. And so my father, on his fourth or fifth day in Nagasaki, was suddenly disturbed to see this plane arriving full of journalists who at that point weren't very interested in Nagasaki because they'd already been to Hiroshima and written the stories the government wanted them to write. And they told my father, "You know, MacArthur's sore as hell at you, and he's censoring all your dispatches." And at that point, my father realized that he lost his scoop and that none of the stories conveniently run up to Tokyo for him by the military police were actually getting sent back to Chicago. So at that point, he decided to just relax, as it were, go up to the POW camps, take his time in Nagasaki, and try to write something more ample, as it were.
Tell us about your father's going into the camps in the area.
Well, remember, after 4 or 5 days in Nagasaki, he figured he'd done about all he could do, and this press junket had convinced him that none of it was doing much good. So he set set off for the camps, which were within about a 30-mile radius of Nagasaki, and these were among them the largest Allied POW camps in Japan. They contained American, British, Australian, Dutch prisoners. One camp, the first one he went to, was the largest prison camp of all. It had 1,700 men. And I think in some sense he felt, well, maybe they would have some version of the bomb story that he hadn't heard before. And after all, some of them had seen both bombs drop from their particular vantage point. They could look north to Hiroshima or southwest to Nagasaki. But he was really, I think, unprepared for the suffering he met. These were men who had been, some of them, in prison for 3.5 years. They'd been worked as slave labor in coal mines that had been declared unsafe back in the 20s. They had suffered from just every kind of disease you can imagine, from dysentery to scurvy and protein edema and beriberi. They had ulcers in their legs so bad that they would pee in them to kill the pain. They'd been starved essentially on 500 calories of gloppy rice a day. And the most dramatic part was they weren't aware the war was over. They thought something might have happened because most of the Japanese guards had fled, but they were scared of leaving the camps themselves because they thought it might be a trick and they would be machine gunned as soon as they left, because many of their colleagues had been tortured or beaten and killed over the years. So my father waltzed into camp in his khakis, looking very healthy, went to the commandant's office, and a few minutes later the commandant called everyone together and announced that the war was over and they were all free men. And what my father was then able to gather, which is so historically valuable, is the first-person accounts of these men who had been through something pretty awful for years. I mean, these camps were far, far, far worse than the equivalent Nazi POW camps. The death rate was 8 times higher. And they hadn't had time to sort of collect their thoughts, so they really spilled their guts to my father. And I think that's some of the most dramatic material in the book.
Why were those dispatches shelved?
Well, that's a good question. One possibility is that it was MacArthur's bureaucracy at work. He killed a number of my father's stories over the years, even though my dad had been the only journalist to win a Pulitzer under his aegis at that point. And he may have felt that this was just more Weller being an annoyance. At the same time, there was a big U.S. government attempt to make the Japanese into our allies as soon as possible. It's why a lot of Japanese were given clemency in the war trials afterwards. I think there's also a sense that people wanted to move on. They had had years and years of Japanese savagery, and we didn't need more accounts of this. And at the same time, these accounts are really laced with first-person visions of watching the atom bomb go off. So it would be much easier to censor the stories completely than pick out paragraph by paragraph, because the bomb crops up a lot of them.
Yeah, and it seems that the censorship was not a fine surgical operation. It was, you know, take an axe and chop.
Well, I think by this point it had become that. And remember, in mid-September, MacArthur had introduced a code of censorship throughout Japan that obtained through 49 of not discussing the bomb at all. And Truman had actually a week before that, send a secret memorandum around to the heads of all print and radio broadcast media in America, demanding that there be no discussion of the bomb whatsoever until he lifted this. He made it clear this was not censorship, but essentially it was censorship. So on some level, even if my father's stories had gotten through, they wouldn't have been published in any event.
Hmm. In your essay at the close of the book, one of the things that you say is that the Japanese POW camps are one of the great omissions, convenient erasures of World War II. Yeah. Now with this book, are we seeing some scholarship in this area of history?
Well, there's been some scholarship. I mean, I don't want to pretend that you know what I've done is utterly groundbreaking. I mean, there's a superb book called Prisoners of the Japanese by an Australian scholar named Gavin Dawes that to me is one of the great books of World War II history. But there's some way in which there are no marvelous, witty films like The Great Escape about the Japanese camps. They were just too relentlessly awful. I mean, it's very hard to think of many, many movies in which the Japanese prison camps occur at all, and certainly not in the United States. And there were a number of forces at work to silence this. I mean, the U.S. government actually got a lot of ex-POWs to sign documents promising not to say a word about what they'd suffered on their return home, because there was such a deliberate attempt to make the Japanese into our allies. Indeed, you could argue that the weeks before, between the surrender and the actual treaty, allowed the Japanese to destroy a paper trail that the Nazis say were not able to do so. So I think also that just the relentless suffering is very hard to dramatize in a way that's appealing in any way.
Hmm. What were the hell ships?
The hell ships were kind of the last story my father stumbled on really by accident. The hell ships were Japanese cargo ships, generally owned by the large companies like Mitsubishi and Nippon Steel, that were used to transport the Japanese prisoners all over the Pacific. Remember, the Japanese had taken Malaya and the Philippines and what's now Indonesia and such, and they were transporting the prisoners generally back to their prison camps in Japan to be put to work as slave labor, and there were, I think, about 140,000 white Allied prisoners through the course of the war. And many, many of these traveled on these hell ships, and the conditions were awful. The story my father stumbled on in Camp 17, after he got stories of what the camp had been like, naturally he asked the prisoners how they'd gotten there. And many had arrived on what became known as the death cruise, one of the worst of these voyages in which 1,600 men were put in the cargo hold of one Japanese freighter in Manila in December of 1944. By the time they made it to Japan in early February of 45, there were only 300 left alive. They'd gone without much food and water. There'd been cannibalism and vampirism, meaning blood drinking. There'd been lots of murder. There'd been a great deal of starvation and fever and disease. And it's just a horrific tale, but it's a typical tale. And it's a story that's really pretty omitted from history. I mean, the Japanese military archives don't even mention that hell ships existed. And you have to look pretty hard to find accounts of them. And the accounts that my father did of these, which make up about a quarter of the book, were the the first and by far the longest contemporary account of a health ship voyage.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Anthony Weller, son of journalist George Weller. George Weller was the first Allied journalist to reach Nagasaki after the atomic bomb struck the city on August 9, 1945. Weller was also the first reporter to enter nearby Allied POW camps, but his dispatches from this point in the war on Nagasaki and the POW camps were never published in the Chicago Daily News, his paper. They were stopped in Tokyo by U.S. censors. Now they have been published in the book First Into Nagasaki, The Censored Eyewitness Dispatches on Post-Atomic Japan and Its Prisoners of War, the book edited and with an essay by our guest, Anthony Weller. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon if you've got a question or a comment. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The dispatches in First Into Nagasaki include a story of two civilians who survived on Wake Island for a number of months after the island was attacked by the Japanese, and they were eventually taken to a POW camp. Logan Kay, also known as Wake Island Scotty, and Fred Stevens, Logan Kay of California, Fred Stevens of Iowa. When and where did your father meet them?
Well, he met them at one of the prison camps that he went to after his time in Nagasaki, and heard this story that was difficult to believe. And oddly enough, it's a story that doesn't occur in any of the Wake Island books that are out there. I mean, Wake Island was a relatively important small island in the Pacific due to its strategic location that the Japanese very successfully took right after they hit Pearl Harbor, and Pan Air Company, a kind of version of Pan Am, had been building a base there, and so there were a number of Marines there, but it was really a very small force, and these two men managed to elude the Japanese on a very flat island with no natural cover for nearly 3 months by sort of burrowing during the day or sleeping in these huts that were scattered around the island and foraging for canned goods that had been left in the huts by men building these bases, of which they were one. These guys were civilians, and they survived for I think it's 87 days, something like that, until they were finally captured by the Japanese. They were not executed. They were sent along with the other Wake Island survivors to a prison camp, and then my father happened to meet them, and one of them, Scotty, had, against all odds, kept a diary for his whole time and had hidden the diary, managed to recover it before he was sent to the prison camp, and gave it to my father, who was able to reproduce most of it. And how these men kept their sense of humor, I mean, they referred to their different huts they were staying in as the Mark Hopkins or the Hilton or the Ritz-Carlton, and these poor guys were just lying there gradually starving and not daring to move a muscle during the daytime in case a Japanese soldier would see them and shoot them. And it's a lovely dose of humor in a book that has plenty of horror in it.
Yeah, plenty of horror. How did your dad deal with the horror of it all?
It's a good question. I mean, when I was a kid, he would tell me the adventure version of this, you know, how he got in and impersonated an American officer, et cetera. When I would ask what Nagasaki was like, he would say, oh, you don't really need to know that. When When I got older, he would say, well, it was pretty much the worst thing he'd seen. And he'd seen a lot of horror in his lifetime. He saw no end of wars. I think he had very mixed feelings about it. You know, he sort of parsed the moral question by saying once that he felt pity but no remorse, that the Japanese military had cleared him of any remorse. I mean, he'd been in at the fall of Singapore and the fall of Java. He'd seen an awful lot of American civilians who should have died of old age on Key West, instead die battling for a bit of a Solomon Island in their youth. So I think he was glad the war was over, and he felt deep compassion for what had been done to the victims. At the same time, the Japanese had started the war, and it was they who had placed their bomb factories and submarine factories in the heart of a civilian city. And so I think in the end he felt the worst crime of a war was to begin it.
Mm. He also felt, I don't know if anger is the right word, I would use that word, anger, contempt for a military leader like MacArthur, for the sloppy reporting of some of his peers.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Oh, that's absolutely fair. And I think he felt, what he continued to feel well into old age was a sense that, I guess fury would not be too strong a word, that the censorship had prevented the American people from knowing what had gone on there at a moment when, had they known that 5-6 weeks had passed after this event and we still had not sent any medical aid, that the American people would have been furious. And indeed, the medical aid that finally reached Nagasaki was sent by the Navy, in a way behind MacArthur's back. It was not sent by MacArthur. And I think my father felt that because his original dispatches contained so much medical information that he gleaned from the very alert Japanese doctors, that I think he had the hope that maybe MacArthur would read them and say, this is absurd, I've got to send medical teams down there right away. And of course he hadn't, and he didn't. And that really stayed with my father well into a blurred, very old age.
Mm. That's another interesting part of this story, isn't it? MacArthur and Nimitz.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reason that my father's Hellship stories actually got through and were published is because my father didn't even try to send them from Japan. He sent them from Guam when he was under Admiral Nimitz's aegis once he got out. And Nimitz couldn't approve sending the Japanese stories. But I guess because the Hell ships were, in a way, maritime stories, he let them through. There was all through the war a kind of mini war going on between MacArthur and the U.S. Navy. And, of course, a certain number of the deaths on Hell ships, something like a third of them, were a result of friendly fire. MacArthur knew which Hell ships were carrying U.S. prisoners, and he bombed them anyway.
There was another Allied journalist, an Australian, who made his way to Hiroshima.
Right.
And arrived there when your father was arriving in Nagasaki. And his reports got out, and apparently he was able to do that, spend that day there, because the Navy didn't prevent him from going in there and getting his report out.
Right. But, well, this was a very astute Australian named Wilfred Burchett, who my father had reported with in New Guinea a year earlier. And Burchett was very smart. He actually got into Hiroshima 3 days before my father got into Nagasaki. And he got in there with the assistance of somebody on the Navy who was delighted at the notion of a journalist attached to Nimitz getting ahead of any journalist attached to MacArthur. And so Burchett made his way into Hiroshima. He spent the better part of a day there, got his story out, and came back to Tokyo only to find that the general from Tinian, where the bombs had been sent off on their planes, had called a press conference to absolutely disprove and discredit everything Burchett had written. And Burchett was prepared to defend himself, but of course he was whisked away and his story was taken from him and his photos were taken from him. And the difference between the two of them is my father was able to stay on in the area for 3 weeks, whereas Burchett only had an afternoon. And it's very interesting to compare Burchett's version, which speaks of what he calls the atomic plague, to the versions of those junket reporters I mentioned earlier who arrived in Hiroshima essentially a few hours after Burchett, but because they were kind of towing the party line, their stories have a really different flavor. And Burchett ran into them and told them, look, you guys should go into the hospitals. That's where the real story is. And they didn't. So.
Yeah. It seems your father called it pre-censorship, but we today probably would call it self-censorship, but there was a lot of that going on.
Sure, sure. Well, remember that the reporters at this point had, and this is not an idea that should be foreign to us these days, had learned very early on that if they said the wrong thing, their stories would not get through. And in those days, there weren't cell phones. There was simply no way to get a story through. And it was not even wildly dreamable that a newspaper would run a story that had not been passed by censors. Because then the newspaper, not the journalist, but the newspaper would lose accreditation. So if the New York Times guy in Singapore somehow got a story out that wasn't passed by censors and the New York Times ran it, they would lose their berth in Singapore. And this was just unthinkable. And so if you think of this going on for year after year after year, it's only natural that there'd be a kind of pre-censorship. You know, now they do it differently. You embed a reporter and he bends over backwards to appease his hosts because he's flattered to be there. I mean, I think that the ultimate lesson of this book is how invaluable a rogue reporter is.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And also the value of an organization that stands by its reporters.
Sure.
And one of the things that your father, in a piece he wrote after the war, well after the war, he wrote a piece, an article for an anthology of reporters' memoirs,
mm-hmm.
and he saluted the Daily News. He said he, quote, was not busted by his organization.
Right.
And that happened to other people.
That's right. It's kind of hard to imagine now, but really the version of World War II that we got was the version that got through the censors. And I'm just now going through steamer trunks of my father's archives to put together a second volume of the best of his World War II reporting to come out in a year or so. And it's interesting to see the original dispatches and see paragraphs, pages, just lopped off by the censors. And see in many places, let's say Singapore, where there were British censors, they were very, very attentive to every syllable. I think the American censors would just cut out a whole story, which in the end ends up being more daunting to a journalist.
Yeah. You know? I don't know if you have any thoughts on what we might see in the upcoming Ken Burns documentary.
Well, I think what we're going to see, of course, I haven't had an advanced look, though I've spoken to some people who have, who all praised it highly. I hope that what it will do will be remind American viewers of what a world war really means. I mean, it's just a phrase to most of us now, unless we're old enough to remember it, and few of us are, I think. And the notion of a war that grips an entire world and encompasses an entire world in a time when to go from here to there meant something different. When my father was sent from Addis Ababa to cover the fall of Singapore, it took him 10 days to get there. You know, now it would take a day. And I think it will perhaps remind us also of how much the 19th century really lasted well into the 20th century. An awful lot of that World War was fought in places that looked like they had in 1880. And I hope it will remind us, too, of how inglorious there is. I mean, that war can be glorified, and there's nothing glorious about a war in which 55 million people who were civilians die and 22 million combatants die. And I think leaders too often want to go to war to prove something. And I think anybody who went through World War II will tell you it is something to be avoided at all costs.
There, we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Yeah.
Anthony Weller, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anthony Weller is the editor, and as well as editing, he's also provided an essay for his father's dispatches from Nagasaki. The book, First into Nagasaki, The Censored Eyewitness Dispatches on Post-Atomic Japan and Its Prisoners of War. These dispatches written by Anthony Weller's father, George Weller, the legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Daily News.